Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Today we're doing a deep dive into the life, the legacy, really the final words of Lisa Marie Presley. I mean, American royalty, Elvis's only child. Her entire life was lived under this incredible spotlight.
It really was. And what's fascinating here is our source material.
Exactly. We're looking at her upcoming memoir, From Here to the Great Unknown. And this isn't, you know, some ghostwritten thing.
No, not at all. It's compiled by her daughter, Riley Key.
Right. From these extensive, really raw audio tapes, Lisa Marie recorded herself before she died. So this is her voice, her unfiltered final testament.
It's incredibly intimate.
We're trying to get beyond the headlines, you know, understand what she was really grappling with. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, our goal here is to look at a life defined by these huge extremes. Incredible fame, yes, but also just staggering loss and this constant, desperate search for who she actually was, separate from it all.
You listen to these tapes, apparently, and you hear the person, not just the icon.
Definitely. Someone fighting to define their own reality against a legacy that was just completely overwhelming.
And that reality, it starts in Graceland, doesn't it? Born in 68, right into the center of Elvis's world.
The absolute epicenter. The memoir apparently paints this picture of her early life as almost dreamlike.
Yeah, you hear about the private jets, the ponies, all that stuff was real.
But mixed with this this constant undercurrent of unease, her father's instability, his decline, it was there.
So the extravagance wasn't the whole story. It was sort of the foundation for this inherited narrative, as you put it.
Precisely. And then her parents divorce when she's only four. Suddenly she's split between these two completely different worlds.
You've got the what the book calls the surreal nocturnal kingdom of Graceland.
Right. And then her mother, Priscilla's much more, let's say, structured life over in Beverly Hills.
That creates this immediate tension, right, between the myth and just normal life, or as normal as it could be.
Exactly. Two lives, but always seen as the king's daughter.
But the event that really seals that narrative, the defining moment. It has to be Elvis's death, right? 1977. She was only nine.
Absolutely pivotal. The sources really stress this. It wasn't just losing her father, which is traumatic enough.
Of course.
Instantly, she becomes this public symbol of loss. She's forced into embodying his legacy right at the moment of her deepest personal grief.
Imagine having to share your dad's death with the entire world like that at 9 years old.
It's an impossible weight. You lose your father, and in the same breath, you're handed this global myth.
A crown she never asked for, like you said.
And you see the reaction to that pressure in her teenage years.
Oh, right.
A lot of rebellion.
Oh, yeah. The sources talk about a really intense period of acting out, pushing against these suffocating expectations.
She was looking for things that were the complete opposite of that polished Graceland image.
Drug use, getting into punk rock, ending up in therapeutic boarding schools.
It wasn't just typical teenage stuff, was it? It feels like this visceral pushback against a life story she felt trapped in.
Yeah, a life owned by a narrative she didn't write.
And her choices later, especially her marriages, they seem like extensions of that same search, trying to find someone who got it.
Who understood that bizarre level of fame.
Which brings us to probably the most talked about one, Michael Jackson, 1994.
Okay, so this is where it gets really interesting. The book apparently doesn't frame it as just a celebrity pairing.
No, it suggests it was more profound for her, a search for a fellow soul, someone who understood that profound abnormality of a childhood lived under a global microscope.
Two kids from these massive kind of dysfunctional dynasties, maybe seeking something real in each other.
It makes you see it less as just tabloid fodder, doesn't it? More like a meeting of two people who lived in similar, incredibly isolating bubbles.
Yeah, she thought she could understand him because of that shared experience.
Exactly. But while those relationships got the headlines, maybe the real breakthrough in her finding her own identity, that was her music.
Right. The first album, To Whom It May Concern, in 2003. That felt like a statement.
A very deliberate public act of self-definition. She had this great smoky voice, wrote these dark confessional lyrics.
You must have taken incredible guts, though. I mean, everything she did musically was instantly compared to Elvis.
Always. Every single note, every lyric, judged against this monumental legacy. It was such a fraught process trying to carve out her own artistic space.
So the biggest challenge wasn't really other artists.
No, it was the inescapable godlike phantom, as some sources put it, of her father's legacy.
But she kept at it. And that later work, like Storm and Grace with T-Bone Burnett, That felt different.
That was a real turning point, professionally. Much more stripped down, rootsy, mature, critically acclaimed.
That felt like the moment she was really seen as a creator in her own right, not just the heiress, finally taking control of her own story.
And that desire for control, for authenticity, it shaped her whole philosophy, didn't it?
Yeah, her worldview seems heavily influenced by loss, obviously, but leading to what the sources describe as a kind of spiritual realism. What does that mean, practically speaking?
Well, it sounds like she had zero patience for superficiality, for pretending things were okay when they weren't.
Okay.
She saw darkness and pain as just part of life, not things to be fixed or wished away with positive thinking, you know?
So she wasn't chasing the Hollywood version of happiness?
Not at all. She was committed to emotional honesty, even when it was brutal. The sources use this analogy. She wasn't trying to avoid the storm. She was a storm chaser.
Wow. Rejecting those perfect curated celebrity images.
Fundamentally. And digging into the sources, you see maybe three core drivers behind that search.
Okay, what are they?
First, obviously, this intense need to be seen as herself, separate from Elvis, that fueled her music, her choices, everything.
Makes sense.
Second, and maybe the most powerful driver for her, was to protect her family. Motherhood was her anchor. She's apparently ferocious about her kids.
You can see that. And the third?
The third shows that internal conflict. To honor her father's legacy, but on her own terms. Trying to show the human, flawed person she knew, not just the myth.
Balancing the legend with the real man. That's tough when the world only wants the legend.
Incredibly tough. And her whole approach to hardship was this: defiant endurance. She didn't run from pain. She seemed to absorb it, channel it.
Into her art or just into how she lived her life?
Yeah, this mix of raw vulnerability and hardened resilience. She acknowledged the hurt, lived with the scar, but keep going.
But that capacity to endure, it was tested beyond anything imaginable, wasn't it? With the death of her son, Benjamin Keoff, in 2020.
The ultimate tragedy. Suicide. She described that loss as something that just shattered her soul, utterly unsurvivable.
And the audio tape she made after that point. They form the heart of the memoir's final section.
Apparently so. Consumed by this visceral, unending, absolute grief. It's reported she battled opioid addiction again in those final years.
Just trying to stay alive for her daughters.
Yeah.
Riley, Finley, and Harper.
That seems to have been her sole focus. And her honesty about that grief, about it being unsurvivable, that became her final message in a way.
How so?
Her public writing, her advocacy around grief awareness. It really pushed back against that societal pressure to just get over it or move on.
Right. That idea that grief isn't just a phase, it's a permanent alteration of one's being.
Exactly. Demanding that we acknowledge the reality of that kind of profound suffering.
Which brings us back to the memoir itself and Riley's role, completing it, weaving together her mother's own words.
It makes the book this unique dialogue, doesn't it? Between the living and the dead. Riley is the interpreter, the loving editor.
Turning her mother's raw experiences into this final testament.
And showing that maybe Lisa Marie's ultimate legacy wasn't the name or even the music, but that relationship with her children and her absolute commitment to speaking her truth, no matter how difficult.
So what does this all mean when you step back from it all? Lisa Marie's story, especially told in her own voice like this, it feels like this profound meditation on, well, on inherited stories and finding your own way to be resilient.
Absolutely. And there are some powerful insights we can draw. I think the emotional insight is incredibly clear. Grief isn't a neat process you just finish.
Right.
It's more like a landscape you learn to live in. And true healing, if that's even the right word, comes from carrying that pain with love and brutal honesty.
Okay. And intellectually?
Intellectually, it forces you to confront the paradox of legacy. Her life really makes you ask, what's the actual value of inheriting this massive fame, this myth, if you have to sacrifice your own self to maintain it? What's the cost?
That's a heavy question. And what about a universal lesson, something anyone can take away?
I think the universal insight is that authenticity is actually a form of survival. Maybe the form of survival.
What do you mean?
Her story suggests real resilience doesn't come from putting up a strong front, pretending you're untouchable. It comes from the courage to be vulnerable, to be true to your own messy, complex, sometimes painful experience.
That feels right.
Yeah.
In this world we live in, so obsessed with polished images, curated perfection, especially with celebrities, Lisa Marie's final words feel like a necessary corrective, a really sobering one.
Definitely. It just shatters that illusion that wealth and privilege automatically mean happiness or stability. It reminds you of the huge psychological toll that kind of inherited fame can take. and the sheer strength it takes just to endure it.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.